Hello, fellow Kentuckians and other friends, and welcome to episode 16 of my Old Kentucky podcast. My name is Robert Connie, and joining me as always is Jasmine Smith. Jasmine, how are you today?
I'm doing good. How are you, Robert?
I'm doing great. Doing very well. You know, the last time we recorded was last Sunday. This has been a long gap between episodes.
Right. There's been a lot that's happened.
But today, we're going to be talking about two big issues and then several other issues of news. We want to talk to you first about the Yum Center, which has been in the news again recently, and also about the University of Louisville's accreditation issues, which seem to have come back into the news as of the last time that we've recorded. And then we'll talk to you about some other stuff also, but because these are some big issues.
This is a pretty U of L heavy episode.
It is. It's U of L heavy. And let's get into it.
All right.
Okay, Jasmine, the Yum Center has been back in the news because of some comments from Tom Jurich and because of some posturing by the Louisville Metro Council. But I thought today it would be a good idea to go all the way back to the beginning of the Yum Center and talk about how and why all of these things are issues.
That's a good idea, because I didn't live in Louisville when all of that happened. It was just like, I didn't really pay attention, and then one day there was this super nice arena, and all I heard was that the taxpayers were paying for it.
Right.
So what all happened?
There's certainly a lot that went on. I was living in Louisville when it started. I moved away when it was going on, and when I moved back, there was a huge arena. So, okay, back in 2005, where were you in 2005, Jasmine?
Well, I was here in 2005. I was in Bullitt County.
That doesn't count. That doesn't count. Well, okay, what can count?
I was here-ish.
Well, here-ish. Okay, back in 2005, Ernie Fletcher was the governor of Kentucky, and the idea to build a Louisville arena bubbled up. But the idea immediately was met with problems. So the state government said, you know, we don't want to spend money on arena. There's bigger issues. We need to fund our Medicaid. Even the Louisville delegation to the state government was very split on the idea. And then Lieutenant Governor Steve Pence, who's from Louisville, he put together a pep talk for the Louisville delegation at the state government at Locust Grove and was like, everybody get on the same page. We want to have this thing built. They did. They got on the same page. The Louisville delegation was like, okay, let's build this arena. The biggest obstacle in the beginning of the project was site selection. There were all kinds of sites that were discussed, but the main sites were a waterfront site between 2nd and 3rd, which is referred to as the LG&E site, which obviously is the one that they eventually selected. There was a different site between 2nd and 3rd, bounded by Muhammad Ali and Liberty, which is further away from the water. It would have been bounded by the 3rd Street Dive Bar, if you've ever been there, and the Episcopal Diocese on the other side. So that was referred to as the Water Company site. There's not really much there now, but back then they thought about building the arena there. It's about exactly the same amount of size. And then there was the idea of a new arena at the fairgrounds, which is pretty close to campus. The silos were one of the places that were discussed. So anyways, these were the major sites. The LG&E site, which was selected, a site further away from the water, downtown, called the Water Company site, and the fairground site, which would be closer to campus. So David Jones and John Schnatter. David Jones is a CEO and founder of Humana, and John Schnatter is John.
Right.
They funded a study on the LG&E and Water Company sites and determined that the Water Company site would cost about $120 million less and would be about exactly the same otherwise. Now, James Ramsey, Tom Jurich, and Rick Pitino lobbied very heavily for the LG&E site, the one that's closer to the water, the one that was eventually selected. The most dramatic appeal for the LG&E site came when Rick Pitino told WHAS 11, the TV station, that Louisville is not playing at the Water Company site. He flat out said that's not going to happen, and this was always envisioned with the University of Louisville as the main tenant who would play there. And so, you know, when it came down to selecting between the two downtown sites, the University of Louisville delegation was very heavily invested in the LG&E waterfront site.
Do you know maybe why Rick Pitino and the U of L people were so against the other one? Is it like location? Is it that the LG&E site was more like central downtown, right on Main Street, or is there any reason?
There was one thing that I read where Tom Jurich said that they had already begun using these drawings of downtown, which included the Muhammad Ali Center and the Yum Center next to each other, as recruiting tools. So, you know, they were very invested because they were like, this will be a marquee place right downtown. part of it all. The water company site was further away. It wasn't necessarily going to be part of the skyline. You wouldn't be able to see it from the water. You wouldn't be able to see it from the interstate. You know, it just wasn't as sexy. It wasn't as cool. Now, this does leave out the fact that a lot of people, and Tom Jurich in retrospect says they really did favor the fairgrounds on campus site, but the state government and many of the other government funders were very opposed to that, building an on-campus arena for the University of Louisville. They really wanted, if they were going to include public, they wanted downtown in Louisville. Now, again, $120 million, that would be, the total debt for the arena ended up being, the construction costs were $573 million, so that would have cut about one-fifth or more off of the cost. So that was a significant increase in cost to get this thing downtown. So eventually the task force that was created to study the issue agreed on the more expensive LG&E site. The only dissenting vote at that time came from John Schnatter. He called the task force a waste of time, and he called it rigged for the Second and Main site. At that vote, he turned around and pledged $5 million for the development of the site, just as a gesture of unanimity. I wish I could do that. You know, be like,
just... I don't agree, but
here's $5 million. Okay, yeah. At the end of the day, Governor Fletcher and by proxy the GOP-led Kentucky Senate and U of L, they very much wanted the Second and Main site, where while the rest of the parties really wanted the cheaper option. At one point when this was being discussed in the Kentucky legislature, the Democratic-led House, they only approved money if it was for the water company site up further away. They thought it was a very bad idea to spend more money. The state senate, after it was approved by the task force for the Second and Main site, they stripped that out of the bill approving of the funding and sent it back to the House, who eventually relented. In the end, the University of Louisville, as the main tenant, got what they wanted. That's what they wanted out of those two sites. Here's how the whole thing was paid for. The total debt for the arena was, like I said, $573 million. The biggest contributor to the cost was $256 million from what's called tax increment financing. Jasmine, have you ever heard of the TIF?
I've heard the name. That's all I know about it.
Okay, so that's what I figured. I think this is a word that all people probably have heard. They don't really know exactly what it means.
Right.
This is money that would be going to the state government. So there's an area around the Yum Center. At the original time when they put this together, it was a 6-mile area around the Yum Center, which all of the taxes which are paid in that area, so property taxes, sales taxes, corporate income taxes, and income taxes in that area, a big portion of those do not go into the general fund that funds the Kentucky state government and instead go to the construction of the Yum Center. So it's a way to allocate money from the state that does not actually increase taxes. So for me, I work in the TIF area. You work in the TIF.
I work in the TIF
you
area.
You work in the TIF area. So anytime we go to lunch and pay sales taxes on what we buy, a large portion of those sales taxes actually go towards funding the Yum Center. So that was the biggest contributor to the cost at the time when they drew this up, $256 million. Then the city of Louisville pledged at a minimum to pay $206 million to the arena. So this would be a line item in their budget. It is not some sort of TIF fund. It's not some sort of fancy, we don't know exactly how much it's going to cost. This is a line item in the budget that the city of Louisville is going to pay. And when it was originally put together, there was a range. There was a minimum amount that the city of Louisville would agree to pay and a maximum amount that the city of Louisville would pay. And the amount that they allocated would fall in between that range every year. But it would be depending on how the TIF goes, because I guess this should have been implicit in what I said, but in case you didn't get it, the TIF tax is not an exact science. You don't know how much you're going to get
right.
Any particular year. You know, if the TIF didn't come up with as much money, the city of Louisville would be expected to pay more, closer to the maximum. And if the TIF did really well, they thought that they would probably pay closer to the minimum amount. Then there was some funding from fees, luxury suite revenues, naming rights, etc. A ticket tax, a certain amount from each ticket would go towards paying the arena cost. So, and that would made up the rest of the funding. But the two biggest chunks were from the TIF tax and the city of Louisville's line item on their budget. And $37 million was supposed to be for naming rights and Yum Brands, who got the name, the
right.
Yum Center. They ended up paying about $13.5 million of branding for 10 years, which is about half of what they expected. So right off the bat, things didn't quite come in as they expected.
So they thought that Yum would pay more.
They thought whoever would end up paying. I mean, it wasn't a guarantee.
Well, they didn't know at the time who was going to do it.
They just thought it would bring in about $37 million. Okay, so there were people throughout this entire process. Larry Clark, many House Democrats. Larry Clark was I guess still is a House Democrat. Doug Hawkins, who's in the Louisville Metro Council, John Schnatter, many other people had serious reservations about the cost of this arena. But the arena authority said throughout the process that finance would not be a serious issue, that the way they drew it up would be fine. And so a lot of people took their word for it, and they went ahead. So UofL, who is over this entire process, they had a very favorable lease as the sole tenant in the arena. Jim Host, who is the chair of the Arena Task Force, he told the University of Louisville trustees that, among other things, the UofL would always have scheduling priority in the arena, and that even if another tenant were interested in the building, UofL would take priority over them. Obviously, if the city wants to build an arena and that's on their list of things to do and they need UofL to agree to play in it, that's something that's important. I guess people kind of had hope that UofL would play ball, but UofL negotiated themselves a very friendly lease, which, you know, as the main driver of revenue for the place, that's their interest to do. So they negotiated a very favorable lease and got scheduling priority, not just on the days that they would play, but the day before and the day after for practices and for women's basketball games, the day of, the day before, and the day after. So that will come back to get us later.
Okay.
Okay, so right now we're still, you know, they're studying the arena, and then they build it. It opened in 2010. I think the first game was against Butler. I think Louisville won. So by 2012, so 2 years after the arena was built, there were new rumblings of very serious problems. So the first thing that happened was Terry Boyd, who's a writer, but at the time he was a writer for Insider Louisville, the website, he identified that under Section 47 of UofL's lease agreement, that if the arena went into default, that UofL would have the option to buy the Yum Center. If you'll remember, their lease also allows them to control scheduling, so they essentially can control the amount of revenue that gets paid into the arena. So it would be a little bit like if, as a renter, if you said, okay, if the owner of the house can't pay the mortgage, I get the ability to buy the house at whatever the default price is, and I'm also not going to pay rent. You know, if I'm
right. That sounds pretty good for UofL.
It's very unusual. It's very strange. And, you know, UofL as a renter, they can control the revenue that comes into it. They essentially can bleed the owner dry and then try to buy it at the end of the day. Now, UofL, right. What they say about this clause is that, you know, this is their arena and Freedom Hall isn't exactly in greatest of shape. So if all of a sudden the Yum Center were liquidated, went into default and had to be sold and their lease was validated and the new owners were like, no, we're not going to let you play in the arena. They wanted to have some place to play. They wanted to have some guarantee that whatever happened, they would be able to play there. So that was their way to control for that. So
I feel like sometimes UofL people say that's their arena, but then when there's mention of like the financial problems and what have you, they say it's the city's arena, it's not our arena.
Right. Well, you know, I guess both of those things can be true at different times. Okay, so then another problem that happened in 2012. The projections used in the bond prospectus for the TIF have never been met. So the TIF, they said it was going to pay for $256 million, came out to a certain amount every year. The projections they put into the bond prospectus when people bought the bonds, those projections have never been met for the TIF. It's never lived up to what the Arena Task Force said it would.
So does that mean they were expecting businesses in the area to do well enough that they would raise a certain amount of money?
Yeah, the idea behind a TIF is that the economic development thing that's put in place wherever the place is will raise the property values, which would thereby increase the property taxes. People would spend more money down there. People would start. And so they projected out how much this was going to create and how much money they would get as part of the TIF.
The arena's right by Whiskey Row, which I'm sure at the time they thought that that would do well, especially with a new arena.
Right.
But Whiskey Row had a fire.
That's true.
It hasn't really been rebuilt yet.
There's all kinds of stuff that went on down there. I mean, and to be perfectly fair, there's a lot of stuff that's down there that's probably there because of the Yum Center.
Right.
It's just has never been anywhere close to what they thought was going to be. In 2013, people started talking about that. Chief among the critics back then was Dennis Frankenberger, who continues to be a critic today of the TIF and the Yum Center. Frankenberger released a white paper that stated that the total bill over 40 years for the Yum Center would be $839 million, which includes a lot more interest on the arena, which is significantly more than the Arena Authority's estimate. He stated that the TIF had not brought in nearly enough money and that the Arena Task Force did poor work in putting it together. He accused them of working backwards from finding the amount that they would need for the arena, figuring out how much the other partners, so like the Metro Louisville and then other partners, would pay for it, and then saying, oh, the TIF will make up the rest. And that's how he said that they came up with their projections. His work is considered by many, including me, to be overly pessimistic, but he didn't hammer home something that is and was absolutely true. The TIF payments were not enough to cover what they expected. Okay, in 2012, the TIF revenue was expected to be $8.2 million. This is an example. $8.2 million was the expectations. It actually ended up being about $3.5 million.
Okay, that's a pretty big discrepancy.
Yeah, and that was before
less
there was...
less than half.
That was before there was a fire.
It
was
exactly.
Yeah. So, okay, that's a big delta, the $5 million delta. To make up the difference, the Yum Center cleared out its maintenance fund and received extra payments from Metro government. So, you know, Metro government was like, we're going to guarantee that we'll pay the minimum payment. So on that year, of course, they got much, much closer. And I think they actually did pay the maximum. And I feel like they've paid the maximum probably ever since then. We'll get into that in a second. Regardless of that fact, though, the S&P and Moody's, who are bond rating agencies, they downgraded the bond rating of the Yum Center to BB, which is a junk rating, based on the difficulty the Yum Center had paying off the bonds in 2013. The bond ratings are not that important to U of L or the Yum Center right now. It's a cosmetic problem. The bonds aren't currently callable, so the Arena Authority can't call back the bonds yet and pay them off that way. So it isn't like it's a big deal, except for on the secondary bond market, but it's definitely a black eye, a significant right. cosmetic issue. And at this point in 2013, the lease from U of L came under considerable heat. In order to make more money at events, you know, this is one strategy that you can undertake. If there's not enough revenue coming in, you can increase the number of events that occur at the Yum Center, which would increase the revenue coming into the Yum Center, increase the amount of money people would spend around there, by and large, increase the revenue that came in from the Yum Center. But because of U of L's scheduling priority, it was increasingly difficult to find another tenant or other things to happen at the Yum Center. In November 2013, ESPN the magazine ranked Louisville as the top men's college basketball team by revenue, with $42.2 million in revenue and $15.5 million in cost, as well as a nation's best $1.35 million in profit per home game. That, of course, added fuel to the fire for critics of the University of Louisville's lease. In a story by Joe Sanka, who currently works for Insider Louisville, but at the time worked for the Leo, Neil DeMouse, who is an expert in publicly owned stadiums, he said that it appeared that, quote, Louisville is really going to be the poster child for TIF disasters. There you go. That was 2013. Things calmed down for a while, but then they heated up again recently. The TIF area has continued to underperform, and Metro government has had to kick in more payments than expected, so they've been paying very close to the maximum. Jasmine, we've been rather critical of Governor Matt Bevin on the show, would you say?
I would say that we have.
Okay, but I will tell you this. He's been significantly more willing to engage on the arena issue than either Governor Fletcher or Governor Beshear. Governor Bevin has called the university's lease, quote, overly generous in one direction, quote, and called for it to change. The Arena Authority, the group that oversees the arena, of course, the people who are on that authority, they change all the time. And Scott Cox is somebody that he appointed as the chairman of the Arena Authority. Mr. Cox reported that the arena probably wouldn't be able to pay its increasing debt payments by 2021 unless something changed. So better financing, a different lease, more money, etc. In response to that, in November of this year, at Metro Council, Democrat Marianne Butler and Republicans Kelly Downard and Angela Leet, they proposed an ordinance which would have eliminated the range of payments. So if you'll remember, the Metro government had the range of payments, the minimum right. and the maximum. It would have eliminated the range and locked in the city's contribution at the maximum amount. So we will give you the maximum amount that we said for here on out, which is, in practice, what has
what
had to happen.
What they've been doing
right.
anyways, right?
So this proposal to do that was attached to provisions allowing Mayor Greg Fisher the ability to take part in a renegotiation with the Arena Authority, hoping to get a revision of the TIF from the state government and some sort of lease renegotiation from the University of Louisville. The full Metro Council tabled this until December, but the Budget Committee unanimously approved the ordinance on December the 9th. There's been a lot of criticism around here about locking in at that maximum amount when there's a lot of other major things that aren't getting paid for in Metro government. There's other things to spend this money on. It's kind of a rehash of the conversation that has been had in both legislative bodies, both Louisville and the state government, since the beginning of this project. So this is probably going to happen, I would expect, but it has not happened yet. But this is why this is in the news. None of this sits well with Tom Jurich, who is the athletic director of the University of Louisville, who told Denise Bentley on the radio after it was seen that Metro Louisville wanted to renegotiate this lease that, quote, "if they don't want us in there, we'll leave," unquote, and went on to say other further things, that he never wanted the arena downtown and instead favored an on-campus arena, and they didn't want it to be, quote, "the only one who helps," quote, "fix the center's problems." So, Jasmine, did you hear about these things when they were on the radio recently?
Yes.
Now that I've gone through many of the things that have happened, how do you react to them now as opposed to what you thought about before you heard that long story I just told?
Well, this whole lease agreement and everything seems to really favor U of L, and it's kind of for their benefit. But Tom Jurich, I don't really understand his comments, I guess. Like, what? Why do you think he's, like, acting pouty and saying, if they don't want us in there, we'll leave?
Yeah, I that makes sense.
I don't really understand.
His comments completely make sense, and I think they're fully understandable given his position. So he has this very favorable lease that he signed, and the whole project is kind of falling apart financially around him, and he's in a position to fix it if he gives up his favorable lease. Now, if you're holding a bunch of good cards in a poker game, you don't just turn those cards back in. You want to hold on to them and use them to further your position. He has no incentive to give up his good lease, and he wants to turn it back around on everybody and change the optical situation. And I think what he's been able to do is to get a bunch of people on his side to be like, well, I never really wanted this in the first place. I'm being called on to fix this huge problem. Why would they give me this lease in the first place if they had such major issues? Which are all good points, but the fact remains that the lease is completely in U of L's favor, overly generous to U of L, in the words of the governor. And if we're going to fix this problem, it's going to have to take some fixing from him. So, I mean, I get what he's saying, but at the same time, I think a lot of it is just posturing.
Right. He wants to keep their lease agreement and blame the problems on the city.
On other people, yeah. Which is, you know, what you do in a negotiation. So here we are. In my opinion, the fight over the U of L lease has been baked into this cake since the very beginning. I don't know if Mr. Frankenberger is totally correct in his historical reading of the arena's TIF district, where he said that, you know, they just kind of backed into it. But I definitely agree with Mr. DeMouse that in Louisville, the TIF has been a complete disaster and has nowhere been close to what we need in order to pay for this arena. So we'll continue to see if anything happens with the lease or with the city's negotiating power as this gets debated in Metro Council, and we'll see what happens. I mean, this is going to require some sort of compromise between the three major partners, being the state government, the city government, and U of L. And we may kick the can down the road like we did in 2012, or we may get something to happen here. But without some sort of change, it looks like we're going to be in major trouble by what Mr. Cox estimates to be 2021.
So is there a time frame when these parties are all supposed to sit down and decide what they're going to do, if anything?
They're not required to do this at all. They're just, I mean, the bondholders will probably make them do that at some point if they can't pay for it. So, you know, there's a huge incentive for them to do this, to get on better footing, to get their bond rating back up, to have this project be fixable. But the way that it's structured currently, it's completely unsustainable. They need either a better lease from U of L so they can get more events and more tenants in the building. They need more money from Metro Louisville, or they need more money from the TIF district. So one of those three things, or a combination of those three things, have to be changed, or else the arena will completely go under.
I think we need an NBA team.
That,
I think that's what needs to happen.
In my opinion, I think a lot of the people who are on that arena task force in the first place were like, just give Louisville whatever release they want. They'll have to renegotiate it because it's going to fall apart, and then we'll get it renegotiated and get an NBA team in here. Now, Mr. DeMouse, who's the publicly owned stadium person, he says that's not that good either. NBA teams are very notorious for not increasing the amount of payments for their publicly owned stadiums as well. So it's hard to say if that would completely solve the problem, but have more events that would certainly address the problem, I think.
I think that's also just my, like, selfish hope that Louisville gets an NBA team.
Me too. We'll split tickets if they come. Okay, so that was a really long story. I will put up a whole bunch of stories, historical stories, from the Courier-Journal and several other sources about this going back into history. So, Jasmine, did you know if you want to read old Courier-Journal articles that you can read them through the Louisville Free Public Library online?
No, I didn't.
Well, Jasmine, if you want to check any of the sources...
Are we doing an ad right now? No.
free advertising for the library. If you want to read these old articles, you will have to get them through the library, because unless you have an archival subscription to the Courier Journal, which costs a good amount of money. So you can get them for free through the library if you want to.
You did a lot of research for that.
Yeah, well, it's a big story, and it is a
it's
lot of money.
It's been going on for a long time, and it's going to continue it seems.
It's a lot of taxpayer money from a lot of different things. All right, but tell us, Jasmine, about the University of Louisville's accreditation issues.
Sorry, U of L. We're going to talk about you some more. But this time, I don't think it's your fault. So if you listen to our podcast at all, you know a little something about Governor Bevin and the U of L Board of Trustees. We've discussed this from episode one, our very first episode, we talked about it. So he abolished the board, he appointed a new one, and then Judge Shepherd of the Franklin Circuit Court put the old board back in place.
Right.
There are still vacancies on the board, however. I think there are 5 vacancies. And there was some testimony in a hearing before Judge Shepherd that suggested that there could be accreditation issues, and we also discussed that on the podcast.
A lesson here. Listen to our podcast every week.
We'll keep you updated on all of these stories. And so here we are now, and there are accreditation issues.
Oh, my gosh.
So first, I thought I'd explain a little bit how accreditation works. Accreditation basically ensures that higher ed institutions meet an acceptable level of quality, and it's also important for being able to receive federal financial aid, which is very important if you want students to come to your school. Colleges have accrediting agencies that are regional, and so accrediting agencies have to have approval from the Secretary of Education. Colleges each have their own regional accrediting agency. U of L's is the Southern Association of Colleges and Schools, which I'll hear and refer to as SACS.
SACS.
So a lot of factors go into maintaining accreditation: curriculum standards, degree programs, financial solvency, faculty to student ratio, faculty quality, all kinds of things. And SACS requirements are called the Principles of Accreditation. Last week, SACS announced that they'd be placing U of L on a 1-year probation period that could potentially extend to a 2nd year. Now, this won't have any effect on funding or their degrees, and they are still accredited, but they are, this year, as of now, on probation.
Let me ask you about this right here. So, have you ever seen the movie Animal House?
No.
Okay. That's too bad. It's about a fraternity, and the fraternity has to go on double secret probation, which doesn't actually carry any penalties. It's just supposed to be, like, extra bad for you. Is this kind of like that? We're, like, talking to you very sternly. You're on probation, but there's not really anything that can happen in terms of accreditation? Or does this, like,
well,
if you're on probation, can it actually lead to you losing your accreditation?
It can lead to that, but that's far, far away. And I've talked to someone who has quite a bit of experience in higher ed, and the way they explain this to me is that there are kind of levels of probation, and this is kind of the very first level of probation. Like, we're putting you on probation for a year, and it's not going to affect your funding or degrees, but then we might have to give you a 2nd year, and then maybe some more time. So,
right, I gotcha.
You have to go a very, very long way before you lose accreditation, and it rarely, rarely ever happens. This is kind of like when we talked about tax-exempt status and nonprofits and political organizations, how even if you're violating the rules of those, it takes a long time before you lose your tax-exempt status.
Right, okay.
This is how I equate that.
It's just the first step in a very long process.
It's the bottom level of probation.
Gotcha, okay.
Why are they on probation? According to U of L and Acting President Pinto's letter to the university, the single reason for this probationary period is the Board of Trustees. And U of L cited issues with its expectation that accredited universities have board members who can be removed only for appropriate reasons and by a fair process, and that the board be free from undue influence from political, religious, or other external bodies. SACS has a principle of accreditation, well, a couple that actually address this, and I think maybe this is where they are coming from when they say that they're placing U of L on probation. One of those is 3.2.4, which says that the governing board must be free from undue influence and protect the institution from influences, in 3.2.5, which says that the governing board has a policy whereby members can be dismissed only for appropriate reasons and by a fair process.
It seems like these were pretty brutally violated.
So this is where Governor Bevin abolished a whole board without a hearing, appointed a new board that was not the correct number of members, and now that the old board is back in place, they are still not in compliance because he has not filled the vacancies. So there's your issue with the dismissing for appropriate reasons and by a fair process, and then there's also maybe an undue influence
from a political body.
A political body there.
That would be the executive branch of the Kentucky state government.
Right. What did Governor Bevin have to say? He released a statement the same day that U of L announced that they were being placed on probation and said, "U of L's accreditation is not at risk, nor will it ever be at risk because of any action taken by Governor Bevin. Anyone who argues otherwise does not have U of L's best interest at heart." So, it seems that the sole reason they are on probation is because of what he did with the Board of Trustees, but says that he has nothing to do with it, none of his actions have caused this, and anyone who thinks so is crazy, I guess.
Jasmine, do you remember when we talked a couple of weeks ago, maybe even a couple of months ago, about Governor Bevin and the tax-exempt status for religious groups?
Yes.
And he was basically like, it's a paper tiger. Nothing has really ever happened for it, and even they put you in trouble, nobody's ever done anything for it. And maybe he's saying the same sort of thing here.
He is, but he's saying that, but he's also saying, and if they are at risk, it's not because of me.
Yeah.
But it seems that it was totally because of him.
Well, yeah. It may be that he's saying, like, the accreditation is not actually at risk.
Right.
They're on probation, but that doesn't actually mean anything. Which...
it means that they're on the first level of probation, that if the board does not come into compliance, they could be at risk for losing it.
Yeah.
But like I said, it rarely ever, ever happens.
Right.
If they let it get that far, it would be terrible.
He's like, yeah, so what? I poked a bear. It's not going to eat me the first time. I'm not going to poke it 9 times. I'm just going to poke it the once. And that's maybe not great. I mean, this may be a reason the Sachs should go and renegotiate, maybe have some less stringent penalties than probation that doesn't actually do anything, like some lower tier penalties than...
Right, and I mean, Sachs doesn't want anyone to lose accreditation, so, you know, they give several chances. There are universities that are on probation for several years. They continue to... as long as they're improving, mm-hmm. and as long as they're working on the problem, they will never lose accreditation.
And it is a little unique, because most of the time, if a university is on probation, it's like, hey, you don't have good enough student-to-faculty ratio, and I see that you're trying to hire some people, and you don't have as much money. We don't want you to lose your accreditation, so we're going to give you some time to fix this. This is, hey, the governor unilaterally decided to do something kind of crazy.
Right.
So what are you going to do here? It's a little bit of a unique situation, which maybe they should figure out a different way to address that kind of issue. Maybe.
Right. And so Louisville was up for reaffirmation of their accreditation in April of 2017. That meeting has now been pushed back to the fall. And this is just speculation, but pushing the meeting back, what that says to me is that means Sachs is giving U of L some time to get their together with the board.
Right.
Like, we were supposed to be up for reaffirmation in April. We're going to just give you to the fall. Like, please just fix this. So I think they're giving them some more time to come into compliance so that they hopefully do not have to extend their probation. So they've got time to get this cleaned up. Takes a lot to lose accreditation. And hopefully those vacancies will get filled.
Maybe you should just have a hearing with these people and be like, what do you have to say? Okay, you're fired anyway. I mean, I don't know. They just checked the box or something. We'll see what happens. It seems like Governor Bevin doesn't seem to think he needs to do anything. And if he's the sole person that's causing this probation and he doesn't think he seems to need to do anything, then...
Right, so I don't know if he'll do anything soon, if he'll wait for an appeal on Judge Shepard's decision. I don't know, but Sachs is giving U of L some time. They have till next fall now to get their board in compliance, and hopefully it doesn't have to go any further than that.
Right. All right, Jasmine, you ready to talk about something different that's not about U of L?
Sure.
Jasmine, a couple weeks ago, you talked to us a lot about charter schools. Well, the Kentucky Board of Education approved a list of principals for charter schools. So I'm gonna read these to you, and you tell me what you think. So local boards of education should be the primary authorizers of charter schools, and the Kentucky Board of Education should have the final say.
So this is what we were talking about when we had our charter schools episode, that there can be different authorizing agencies. Like, there can be a specific agency or it can be a local school board. I guess what's kind of weird about a school board is that they're authorizing their competitors, sort of.
Right.
So yeah. That's a little odd, but that's how most states seem to do it.
Right.
So.
Right. Okay. So the next one, funding for charter schools shouldn't hurt funding provided to other public schools. That seems
like, I agree.
It seems like a nice idea. Let's see if it works. Okay, charter schools need to enter into performance-based contracts with the state. The state board or local boards would be in charge of establishing evaluation criteria to measure academic performance in the organization's finances. So I think this one has to do with how you measure how well the charter school is doing, and that would be how they're judged, right?
Right.
Okay. Charters must be nonprofit, nonsectarian, and cannot be wholly or partially funded by a group that is a religious denomination or affiliation. That seems to be constitutional.
Right.
That's good.
That sounds good.
Charter school teachers should be certified by Kentucky's Educational Professional Standards Board. This is kind of important because not all charter schools have that criteria. Right.
I think that's a really good thing because I think one of the critiques of charter schools is that they may not have
well-trained teachers.
Right, yeah.
Yeah. Some charters, people would say, like, those boards, they keep good people from teaching, they hold people up to arbitrary standards, et cetera, et cetera. But the Kentucky Board of Education seems to think otherwise. Okay, whoever authorizes charter schools should focus on approving the schools in at-risk or underserved populations. So this seems to say, like, don't do, like, open call to anybody who wants to go to a charter school. It should actually be focused on serving people who don't have good schools to go to, right?
Right.
Okay. If there are too many student applications to a charter school, a lottery should determine enrollment. Preference should be given to underserved students.
And I think that's common in how most states do it. Just from what I've read, a lottery seems to be the common way to do that.
High expectations for parental involvement should be outlined and required. That one seems weird to me.
Right. If you're going to be working with at-risk or underserved populations, sometimes parental involvement is difficult.
Yeah, and a lot of times, I mean, parents, especially in underserved populations, it's like you have a single parent who's having to work a bunch, and, you know, that's the whole problem in the first place, is in order to
right.
have money to eat food.
Single parents, kids yeah. in foster care, that's going to be difficult,
it
maybe.
It seems like, and I see, it almost seems like it runs counter to a lot of the other stuff on here. It's always great to have good parental involvement that helps the child substantially, but you know, sometimes that just is an impossible standard to meet. Okay, the state and local school district or board shouldn't be held legally liable for the charter school's actions, so no indemnity. That seems like a good plan. Charter schools should have access to state funding for facilities. That seems interesting. We'll see what happens. This is just the State Board of Education set out as their list of principles. We'll see if they're adopted by the legislature when they go into session. Jasmine, the committee that's investigating the party switching, I think had its...
Stumbo's committee.
Stumbo's committee seems to be in significant problems. Representative Jim Wayne was the head of the committee, which is investigating the potential wrongdoing by Governor Bevin in the midst of the party switching that he's alleged to have asked for. We've talked about this at length. Representative Wayne resigned his post as the chair of the committee in protest because Speaker Stumbo refused his request to issue Russ Meyer a subpoena. So Russ Meyer did not want to testify before this committee. He did not want to say anything that he had done or anything that had occurred. He kind of just wanted to steer clear, I guess, to stay out of the governor's way, maybe. But Jim Wayne, very upset about this, resigned in protest. This is what he had to say. The Speaker does not want any Democratic House member to be subpoenaed by the committee. It appears the Speaker's granting of power to subpoena witnesses was conditional, making our efforts to arrive at the truth regarding charges against the governor impossible. Okay, so that was the quote. After this happened, Representative Arnold Simpson, tried to dissolve the committee, but he couldn't, as a quorum was not present. So they tried to quit.
We thought this story would just go away.
It can't
Here
even
we
go
are.
They can't even disband themselves. They can't even get rid of themselves. So, tweets from Matt Devin after this happened. Despite breathless encouragement from @CourierJournal and @HeraldLeader, Stumbo's kangaroo court collapsed today, but has no quorum to disband. Kangaroo Court assembled by at Speaker Stumbo, too incompetent to even disband themselves, but sure love the extra money they take from taxpayers. I don't know.
What's a kangaroo court?
That's a saying. I actually have no idea where that comes from, but it's just kind of like a court that has no authority or authenticity. It's not like a real court. I don't know where that comes
Maybe
from.
Maybe I should know what that means. I'm an attorney, but I've never heard that before.
You've never heard kangaroo?
No, I haven't.
Really? You've never heard him? Nope. Yeah, it's not something that's commonly heard around the Connie household, but it's definitely something I know what it is. I think going after the media is a little weird, you know? Turns out Matt Bevin walked away with this one with another W.
I'm not really sure what the CJ and the Herald Leader did, but...
Covered it.
Covered
it. Talked about it, which I guess is bad, according to Governor Bevin. Jasmine, you ready for some quick hits? We're late into the show, but we still have a few quick hits.
Go for it.
Okay, so Oklahoma Attorney General Scott Pruitt was named as the head of the EPA. He's very pro-fossil fuel and has sued the EPA many times before. The reason he's a quick hit is because he graduated from Lafayette High School in Lexington and is from Kentucky. How about that?
How about that?
How about that? Okay, another very quick hit. Terry Gill, it was appointed the state economic development head, chief, person in charge. I don't know what the
It's a nice title.
I don't know what the actual title is, but he's in charge of the economic development cabinet for the state. Governor Bevin had yet to fill that. He's been in office for a year as of this week. But he had not yet filled it, and he has indeed filled it by Terry Gill, who was in charge of, I think, the Enterprise Angels Group in Louisville, and I think he was helped to found Federer Printing, which is a company that did printing in Louisville. And according to some people in my office, he's the most attractive man they've ever seen. I think he's a silver fox, Jasmine. You might want to look up some pictures of him.
Okay.
All right. And then, okay, this had just happened today. Huge story. Would have talked about it more at length, but we didn't have time to get into it. The University of Louisville Foundation audit, the audit which was begun by Edelin and continued on with Mike Harmon, was completed. It found a lot of wrongdoing, a very scathing audit towards President James Ramsey, former U of L President James Ramsey. It looks like our next show may also include some U of L stuff. There was some stuff in there about inappropriate benefits that he may have provided to his chief administration officer. Not necessarily inappropriate benefits, but he gave somebody a contract he probably shouldn't have given them. He moved some money from the endowment of U of L to the foundation and provided loans, which he probably shouldn't have done. A lot of kind of nasty stuff, but he has come out and said none of it's true. This audit was completely unnecessary. Meanwhile, it looks like there's some significant problems that were going on. U of L didn't seem to have much pushback, just James Ramsey, private citizen currently. So that's it, Jasmine. We've made it through the end of another show. We're, as I said, late into the show, but how can people get in touch with us?
They can find us on Twitter at @myoldkypod. You can like our Facebook page, My Old Kentucky Podcast. You can find our show notes on Medium, and you can find our podcast on the podcasting app of your choice, iTunes, Stitcher, some other ones.
Remember last week when I said, mash that subscribe button, fam?
Yeah, you said that.
All right, people should do that. All right, everybody, thanks for hanging with us. I hope you learned something. I hope you made it to the very end, and I hope you join us again next week. We will see you then. All of it.